Welcome, everybody. Welcome, everybody. Good afternoon, and thank you all for coming out on an afternoon that is actually sunny. Perhaps the last one we'll see for a bit, but you are indeed going to be illumined by other means in here. I'm Doreen Noyes, the director of the Center for Folklore Studies, and I have a few housekeeping announcements first. First of all, for those of you who are not familiar with CMRS procedures, after the formal part of this talk is concluded, there will be informal conversation in the smaller group that can remain. If you have further things you'd like to talk about with Professor Lindau, please stay and have some refreshments and chat. Secondly, there is a sign-up sheet for those students of Professor Kaplan going around, so you should find that before you take your departure. And then finally, I just wanted to announce our last events of the semester. For the Center for Folklore Studies, be aware that when we get back from Thanksgiving on Tuesday, November 27th, our affiliate, Sean Park, will give her inaugural lecture at the Division of Arts and Humanities with the title Morning Becomes Song, The Ritual Origin of Korean Music Revisited. So you can find the details for that on the CFS website. Then CMRS has another event remaining, a lecture as well with the really thrilling title of Toward a History of Distraction, which sounds like a talk that will keep us all focused, from Shigehisa Kuriyama, who is professor of cultural history at Harvard. So please come to that on November 30th here in this same room, and you will find the details on their website. And finally, jointly, our two centers will be holding a holiday party on December 3rd in our mutual home of 308 Dulles at 4 in the afternoon. So come and celebrate the end of our first long lingering semester. So now to the hortatory part of things. I think that was all the announcements. To the hortatory part of things, welcome to the 6th annual Francis Lee Utley Lecture, which is co-sponsored by the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies and the Center for Folklore Studies in honor of our mutual founder. So we created this lecture to honor both the past and the present of the interaction of folklore and medieval studies at Ohio State, and in particular to honor Professor Fran Utley of the Department of English, who built up both of these fields in a way that fostered both our present institutional strength and our present intellectual energy. Francis Lee Utley lived from 1907 to 1974. He was born in Wisconsin. He studied at Harvard with another great medievalist and folklorist, the ballad scholar George Lyman Kittredge. He came to Ohio State's faculty in 1935, and he remained there through his teaching career and to the end of his life. He founded the Ohio Folklore Society and was its president. He was, in short order, the president of the American Name Society, the College English Association, and the American Folklore Society. If you look into JSTOR at the Journal of American Folklore and look for his name, you will find a very interesting, you know, unfortunately not well remembered essays of his that show that he was really well ahead of our field in recognizing both the diversity of folk tradition and the human fallibility of scholars. His own scholarship bridged folklore and dialectology, medieval and modern literature, and he had a special interest in what he termed the Bible of the folk. So he was quite interested in the ways that oral tradition elaborated on scripture, reinterpreted scripture, adapted scripture, and in particular, he was the great scholar of the medieval and modern folklore of Noah. So his materials are now in the OSU Folklore Archives, which he also founded in 1962, and in 1969 he got around to founding the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies. He is remembered at Ohio State as having been a warm colleague and a particularly welcoming mentor to women faculty who had just arrived at that point at Ohio State and were decidedly not part of the old boys club. And really, in everything we hear about him, we get a sense that he was a founding father to be proud of, which just is not always the case. And so we consider ourselves quite fortunate in this. There are not a great number of scholars who can equal Fran Utley in being at once complete medievalists and complete folklorists, but we are happy today in having one of them, today's guest, Professor John Lindau of UC Berkeley. among his other claims to fame is having served as mentor to some rather notable younger folklorists, including, and notably, our own Professor Merrill Kaplan, who will now introduce our speaker.
Thank you, Dory. I'm in a very good mood. I am really happy. I am really happy to be introducing Professor John Mundo. It's always a pleasure to introduce a colleague. It's definitely a pleasure to be introducing a colleague in one's own field, the more so a colleague who has done such fine scholarship for so long. It is an extraordinary pleasure to be pleasure to be introducing a beloved mentor and friend. So there you have that. But I'll stop embarrassing him, or I'll try to. Professor John Lindo is come to us to astonishingly sunny Columbus, Ohio, from California, the University of California at Berkeley, where he was hired on at a ridiculously young age with a Harvard degree in dramatic languages and literatures. And he's been there ever since as part of really an incredibly strong program in Scandinavian studies, possibly the premier one in the United States, certainly the premier in Old Norse studies, and part of this sort of stealth folklore program, PhD program, the, if not the silent partner, then the less bombastic partner in a folklore program that was extraordinary, you know, and continues to be extraordinarily strong, despite having only one official faculty member, one official one, right here. So been there ever since, except when he has been teaching for shorter stints at the University of Uppsala in Sweden, in Swedish, I believe, and at the University of Iceland, where he taught Old Norse mythology to Icelanders. His monograph is with a wonderful title, Murder and Vengeance Among the Gods, The Myth of Baldur, which kind of permanently fixed scholarship on the myth of Baldur. And it's going up against all the billions of people who have written about Baldur. This takes a certain amount of courage, and he went from the place of battle with victory. He has written numerous invaluable reference works on myth and annotated bibliography, which is still just essential for students of this stuff. A handbook of Norse mythology, which makes it possible for me to teach Norse mythology without my students mutinying. Been part of the editing team of an encyclopedia of medieval folklore, something that really does exist, an edition of Swedish legends in translation, again, so that we can teach stuff to people who do not have Swedish yet. Currently part of an international team writing what's going to be the work on Old Norse myth and religion. Really, his preferred genre of production is the article, and he's written a whole mess of them. Within those, his preferred genres are Old Norse myth, but also legend, particularly from 19th century Scandinavia, particularly legend of the supernatural. So, on a regular basis, Professor John Lindo goes face to face with gods and monsters and trolls, but also the much scarier genre of Old Norse poetry known as skaldic verse. This is truly extraordinary. And not only will he do that, but he has broadened his interest in the Finno-Ugric realm and has become interested in Finnish and Sami and Karelian material. I don't go near this at all. You know how many cases there are in Finnish? No, I haven't. I lost count. So, I'm in extremely good mood. I am just inordinately pleased. And you should be inordinately pleased because I get to introduce him, but you get to listen to him talk. So that is much more interesting than me sort of riffing here. And so I'm going to get out of his way. It is, as I said, my extraordinary pleasure to introduce Professor John Lindo.
I wish I had someone to introduce now. It's really a pleasure to be here to deliver a lecture in honor of Francis Lee Utley, whose work I looked at this past week, as Dory invited you to do. It really is ahead of its time, and I think the thing to say is that 50 years later, we're still worrying about some of the issues that he brought up in that lecture. It's also a pleasure to be at a place that has institutional recognition for my field, medieval studies, folklore, and also Scandinavian studies, and I'm pleased to learn that there are majors in that field at this institution. So thank you very much for inviting me, and I'll plunge into my talk now, which has to do mostly with Old Norse materials. Though I have inserted a couple of words from standard folklore scholarship, just to be on the safe side. And for those of you sitting on this side of the room, in the event that I should have to use a laser pointer, I wish that I had multiple arms. If you were able to do that, I cannot. My colleague Mark Sandberg and I once taught a course in a room like this, and each of us became the other person's extension. It was rather like synchronized swimming. We waved the laser pointer as we went. So I'll see if I can avoid the use of this thing altogether. The kingdom we now know as Norway was, according to our written sources, united as a single entity by King Harald Matadhair in a great sea battle off the southwest coast of Norway around the year 885 CE. You may know this Harald by a different nickname, Harald Fairhair. The two nicknames reflect a vow he had made not to groom his hair until he made himself the king of all Norway. Harald's hair thus stands in as the location on his human body where the political status of Norway was marked, matted and gnarly before union, fair and flowing afterward, a move from disorder to order, from the point of view, at least, of the Norwegian monarchy, the winners who got to write the history. According to Grettis saga, a medieval Icelandic saga, another nickname was born at that same battle. A Norwegian Viking named Unnithur Ulfeksson was fighting against King Harald, whose forces, by the way, included berserks whom iron could not bite. You may wonder whether berserks really existed, and the historical record is that they did, and I don't wish to dispute the historical record. The text is there before you. As you can see from reading it, Unnithur sacrifices his leg to one of these literally bow men in the Old Norse text, and I happen to know that they were berserks, having read the previous paragraphs here. Unnithur was healed then, and he went about with a peg leg for the rest of his life, and was called Unnithur Peg Leg then. The Old Norse name stock was small, and nicknames were common. As with the two examples I have cited, nicknames often pointed to physical characteristics: hair, complexion, eyes, ears, nose, arms, legs. Although we might imagine that losing one leg would constitute a disability, Unnithur went on with his career. He and his Viking partner, one Framtur, went off to the British Isles, harrying in summer and staying over in winter. And there Unnithur found a bride. Framtur helped with the wooing, telling the reluctant father of the bride that Unnithur was bolder than many a man whose legs were fully intact. While out harrying the next summer, the partners met another group of Vikings, and a fierce battle ensued. Two of these Hebridean Vikings extemporized and spoke simultaneously. I had little trouble imagining this situation, but this is what the text says. Extemporized and spoke simultaneously a little verse just before the battle. It's not a deathless verse, but it does have trolls in it. And to this, the Vikings added the disparaging remark, and for us, it's a rare sight to see men go into battle who cannot carry themselves. What these Vikings didn't know was that Unnithur was cunning as well as strong, and he positioned his fleet in a way that gave him the advantage without the enemies knowing it. When battle was joined, Unnithur supported his shorter leg on a large wooden block, and one of the Vikings missed Unnithur with his sword and got it caught in the wooden block. When he bent down to retrieve it, Unnithur hacked off his arm at the shoulder. This mortal wound ended the battle. Afterwards, Unnithur did some more harrying, returned to Norway to find that the king had seized his property, and ultimately, like many others in that position according to the sagas, emigrated to Iceland. As he left, he uttered a verse, too complex for me to try to put on the screen, which has the embedded clause, "Now I must board the ship on one foot to visit Iceland." His great-grandson was Grettir, the eponymous hero of the saga. I've gone on at some length about Unnithur's lack, to show that Unnithur's lack of a leg was simultaneously a part of his identity, as was Harald's politically arranged heir, and yet no serious impediment to his career as a Viking and as an early settler in Iceland. And yes, Merle, we've just done one question already. Unitur probably reached Iceland about 900 or so, or about a quarter about a century before the conversion of Iceland to Christianity. As a poet, he almost certainly knew the pantheon of gods reflected in such diverse locations as are names of the days of the week, place names in the Scandinavian landscape, and especially in the kennings, that is to say, certain locutions in Old Norse poetry, which frequently require a knowledge of the stories of the gods in order to be comprehensible. It's also not unlikely that he might have seen images of some of the myths, painted or incised on shields or inside chieftains' halls. A familiarity with this mythology would certainly have suggested to him that from disability could come ability. I'm sure that many of you know these mythologems, so I'll just go through them quickly. Odin, whose name we see in English form in our weekday name Wednesday, Wodnesday, was the most important god for poets and was also involved in such spheres as warfare and death. He was also the most all-knowing of the gods, we might even say the most insightful. And yet, you all know this, I think, his normal vision was flawed. As the seeress in Völuspá, Cirrus's prophecy, told him, "I know everything, Odin, where you hid your eye." And if that seems difficult to understand, we can turn to the 13th century author Snorri Sturluson, who explained this stanza succinctly. "Allfather went to get a drink from this well of wisdom, but he did not get one until he placed his eye there as a pledge." So he deliberate maiming of himself. And let me quickly clear up a question of translation. Both the poet and Snorri refer to the eye with the word ved, which you can see in this text. I used Carolyn Larrington's translation on the previous slide. I'm a great fan of this translation, actually. I mean, I started out hating it, but she's cleverly fudged all of the problems. But here I fear that Carolyn has made a mistake. She's translated the word ved as wager, which is a plausible meaning, but not the one the word has here. So these are pledges. I'll return to this word in a moment and suggest what might be an even better way to think about these pledges. Odin has many names. Among them are Bil-Egg, weak-eyed, and even Binti, blind, an overdetermination of his one-eyed status. But the reverse of this coin shows up in another name, Bowel-Egg, that is a fire-eyed, a fiery-eyed, perhaps even funeral fiery-eyed. So Odin has only one eye, but he sees the important things better than anyone else does. The seeress knows of something else hidden. Just before addressing Odin about his eye, she makes this statement, referring to herself in the third person, as she frequently does in the poem. While it's possible to construe these lines literally, somehow Heimdall's faculty of hearing is parked under the base of the world tree. There are scholars who would take it that way. We might also easily imagine another main god, a Heimdall lacking one or both ears. This would lead to his having preternatural hearing. A story, in fact, says that Heimdall can hear the grass growing on the earth, and if that's not enough, he can also hear wool growing on sheep. And as the watchman of the gods, he also has preternaturally keen eyesight. He can see 100 leagues away by day or night, and he needs no sleep. As a watchman, he is the complete package. The English form of the name of the god Tyr appears in our weekday named Tuesday, Tivisday. Despite this equation with Mars, Dies Martis, Tyr plays little role in the mythology, but he also is named. Again, I'm sure many of you know this. The story is that with his prophetic vision, Odin foresaw that three children of the god Loki were to harm the gods. He therefore cast one into the sea, where he became the serpent encircling the earth, another one in the world of the dead, where she became the mistress of that realm. The third was the wolf, and wolves are always the trickiest. The gods hoped to bind him with magic fetters, pretending it was a game. But the wolf demanded a pledge of good faith. A hand in the mouth. Tyr was the only one brave enough or foolish enough to offer the pledge, and when the wolf struggled in his fetters, I'm quoting Snorri again here, one of my favorite lines in all of Old Norse literature, all the gods laughed except Tyr. He lost his hand. That's a bizarre sense of humor. For this reason, Snorri says, Tyr was never considered a promoter of settlements among men, and that is perhaps a logical outcome of the pledge of bad faith. So, both Tyr's eye, Odin's eye and Tyr's hand were pledges. Probably also Heimdall's ear. In the early Icelandic legal system, as it has come down to it, to us, pledges were security put up on a loan. These could be either an object of value or a piece of land. As far as I know, Odin's eye and Tyr's hand are the only pledges proper in the mythology, and they play by the laws of myth, not by the laws of property exchange. The objects of value are body parts, and more important, the pledge can never be redeemed. The loans in question can never be repaid. They're more in line with forfeits. And in fact, Ursula Dranka translates Odin's bed in Völuspá this way. And this is how I think of these actions. In all of these cases, the body part is actually more useful when it is separated from the body, not the usual notion of body parts, except in the modern discourse of stolen body parts for medical use. And this is a point of intersection between the material that we're looking at here and especially legend tradition. So these are body parts that become useful when separated from the body. Preternatural sight and hearing result, and a dangerous enemy is neutralized. This being myth, there are, of course, paradoxes involved. One of the primary characteristics of a leader was his bright, shining eyes. But despite his lack of an eye, Odin figures in the mythology as the head of the pantheon and the leader of the gods, the All-Father, according to Snorri. And he figures in Euhemerae's history as the proto-king who established the institution of kingship in the north. This despite his lack of a full pair of bright, shining eyes. Despite his apparent deafness, Heimdall performs his function as guardian of the gods in an oral arena. Now, in a real oral culture, I wouldn't be able to do this. Oral, A-U-R-A-L. When the last battle is to be joined, he will sound the alarm on his horn. It's an oral response for a person who has no hearing. Binding with fetters, I think we would all agree, is manual work. And yet Tyr was able to turn the trick in the end with only one hand. Indeed, Scandinavian mythology trades to an enormous extent on body parts that acquire value only when they are removed from the owners. To begin with, as many of you know, the entire cosmos is made of body parts. These belong to the proto-giant Ymir, and here's the way one anonymous poem recorded in the 13th century put it. This is a microcosm, macrocosm. Small body parts become large parts of the cosmos. And another poet more or less repeated that line and then gave us some, that stanza, and then gave us some additional information. There's certainly a difference between Odin's eye, Heimdall's hearing, and Tyr's hand on the one side, and Ymir's flesh, skull, bones, eyebrows, brain, blood, and so forth on the other side. This does get a little baroque, doesn't it, by the end. The gods forfeited their body parts, voluntarily accepting their maiming, whereas Ymir's body parts were appropriated. He was first slain and then dismembered. In my use of the passive voice just now, he was first slain. I echo the Norse poets. You can see that from looking on the screen. From Ymir's body, the earth was made. The passive voice is not particularly common in this kind of poetry. And the first poem you saw, which devotes only one stanza to the entire matter, completely eliminates agency from the account. his body was made from, the cosmos was made from his body with no indication of how or why that was done. This, of course, puts the emphasis squarely on those body parts and not on any process that was used to create the cosmos. The Grimmismal poet, whose contribution you see on the screen here, leads with this strategy, which must have been formulaic in the underlying oral tradition, and gives us the agency in a second stanza, linking the use of Ymir's body parts by the gods to the creation of a place on Earth where we human beings live, and to the clouds that bring rain to grow our crops, or which will ultimately become our food. I need to do a little bit of close reading on the relevant line. And this was where I feared I would have to use the pointer. The gods are referred to here with the word reyin, so I'll point over here.
Now if we have more screens,
I point there. This is the word that is used to refer to the gods, and it's perhaps best rendered powers. It's a collective most well known, perhaps, in the compound Ragnarök, literally the fates of the powers, that is to say, the end of the cosmos, and we know it, and the onset of the creation of the new cosmos. Of course, this use of Reyn was a deliberate choice on the part of the poet. Although he might have avoided the short monosyllable here, Gov, that we might have expected, because it would not work metrically. We wouldn't like a short monosyllable in final position here. Just look and you see the trochees at the end of all of the lines. He might have avoided the word gods for that reason. He could have used other terms. He might have called them the Æsir, which would work fine, or Tivar, which would work fine. Second, the adjective blíð, cheerful, according to Larrington. Poor Carolyn Larrington. I'm going to do some more bashing here in a minute. This is required for alliteration, so we should be careful with that adjective. The formula blíð reyn, in fact, occurs three times in the poem and once in another poem, always used when B alliteration is required. I personally think friendly or helpful would be a better translation than cheerful, since what's at stake here is the goodwill of the gods toward humans when they dedicate an entire body part to us. I don't think it makes them happy. I think it makes us happy. Now I'd like to show you a version of this stanza from some parallel universe, which is named after me. So I've now emended this poem with something that would work metrically and accurately tells us what indeed occurred. The stanza would indicate that it was not the collective of gods as a whole, but rather Odin and his brothers, they are the son of Bor, who formed the cosmos from the body of Ymir. And one small contribution I'd like to make today is to point out that that formula was avoided and to suggest why that might have been. And namely, because Odin is the speaker of the poem, and it is necessary for him to conceal his identity at this stage of the poem. He's also the speaker of the stanza in Vaptru the Smell, the first poem I put up on the screen, with the same stanza about the creation of the universe. And there, the passive voice used in both stanzas might be a strategy to avoid, a strategy to withhold from its interlocutor, also a giant, the role the gods played in the dismemberment of Ymir. So my thinking here is that this most obvious way to express this this line was suppressed because the speaker is deliberately playing down his own role in the killing and dismemberment of this proto-being and trying to blame it on his tribe as a whole. The Gylfaginning section of Snorri's Edda tells the whole story. Ymir was the first giant. He's the ancestor of all monsters. Having reproduced hermaphroditically, a boy and girl sprang from his sweaty armpit, and one foot begat a boy on the other. This is not normal human procreation. Four sons kill Ymir, whose blood flows in a flood that nearly kills all the rest of the giants. The gods then make the cosmos from the body parts. Thus, the killing of Ymir was the proto-giant slaying, the first one. Every giant slaying thereafter invoked the cosmogonic nature of that first killing and dismemberment. Every time a god kills a giant, we recreate the cosmos. And I still believe that statement. But it wasn't until the 1990s that those of us who work on this material woke up and realized that the killing of Ymir involved a killing within a family. And the slide shows why. As you will see, there are red states and blue states. And Ymir and his monstrous offspring lead down through a figure I haven't mentioned to a giantess who is the mother of the sons of Bor, whom you see as among the blue states. So it's a maternal relative, minimally, I think, 4 degrees away. I think maximally 6 or 7, which is as far out as you could go in Norse kinship. Then became apparent to all of us who work in the field in the 1990s that every giant slaying invoked first the proto-killing, the creation of the cosmos, but it also invoked just as strongly the killing within the family that occurred and the subsequent dismembering of the victim. In juxtaposition with empirical observations about the operation of blood feud, which the sagas confirm was used as mechanism for dispute resolution in stateless Iceland and probably also in Viking Scandinavia before the central authority of the church and king had developed, then pointed out a fatal flaw in the system. The blood feud breaks down when there is killing within a family. That was the major thesis of my 1997 book on Baldur. I'm going to quickly rehearse the argument now, except I never dreamed that anybody had read that. The story begins with the nightmares of Baldur, son of Odin, and his wife Frigg. Here are the family relationships. Frigg extracts oaths from all creation not to harm Baldur, but she overlooks Mistletoe. Loki, whose name you've already heard, finds out. Baldur is now seemingly invulnerable, and for sport, the other gods hurl weapons at him. This is certainly not the notion of sport that we have necessarily, although perhaps standing as I am in the home of an extremely powerful sports, what shall I call it, team, maybe this makes more sense than I thought when I was sitting home in Berkeley. So they're throwing weapons, and every kind of weapon. They're flinging them at him, and this does honor to him. His brother or half-brother Höðr, or Hod as he's called in the translation, cannot participate as he's blind. Loki offers him a dart made of mistletoe. Everybody knows mistletoe is not a weapon, right? But Meryl will explain that to you afterwards, how that works. A weapon made of mistletoe and guides Höðr's hand as he casts the fatal toss. Odin quickly sires another son. His name is not given there, but it's right away in the slide. Baldur's brother was quickly born. Killing is done and instantaneously an avenger is sired. And he takes vengeance on Höðr, kills him. Yet another brother tries to retrieve Baldur from the world of the dead. But the condition is that everything must weep and one old woman won't. That's Loki. Baldur receives a stately funeral and he stays dead. So as I wrote in 1997, the demands of blood feud require vengeance or compensation for Baldur, and it's simply impossible for this to be done, because however many sons Odin sires to kill the previous murderer, he still has a dead son lying before him. A killing within a family cripples the blood feud method. So I would argue, although Baldur's permanent death exposes the fatal flaw in the system, Ymir's broken body is its foundation. Höðr's blindness has hardly gone unnoticed. It worked nicely with the older nature mythological interpretations of the myth, which saw Baldur as a dying god like Baal or Adonis. When that paradigm was finally upended by Jan de Vries in the 1950s, Höðr's blindness became Odinic. De Vries argued that the blind Höðr was a hypostasis of the one-eyed god, Odin. Certainly there's a scale with the one-eyed Odin located between these two sons, the hale Baldur and the blind Höðr. And indeed, when we compared this Icelandic version I've been talking about now with the Danish version of the myth, euhemerized by Saxo Grammaticus toward the end of the 12th century in his Gesta Danorum, you see the Danish king, Hertherus, the analog to Werther, whose body is fully intact, acts alone against Balderus. Hertha's blindness thus attaches to the fact that Loki participates in the killing of Balder by providing the weapon and pointing out the target. Now we're back again with a broken system. And here's another broken system. Not just blood feud, although this is within the blood feud system. It's broken in a different place, in the functioning of fictive kinship. Because Odin and Loki swore a blood brother oath together. And the purpose of blood brother oaths in this literature and culture was to bind the oath takers into obligations of vengeance for one another within the blood feud system. Implicit in this bond is an obvious prohibition on violence against a blood brother, and therefore, by the logic of feud, against the blood brother's kin. Loki swore this oath, but he brought about the death of Odin's son. The system breaks once again. The killing of a brother by a half-brother suggests, too, a problem within the basic kinship system. In what I think of as the most mythic of the heroic poems in Old Norse, this issue is treated explicitly. I refer to Hamdismal, the final poem in the Poetic Edda, the one that marks the demise of the last offspring of Guðrun, the woman whose marriages essentially drive the heroic cycle. She dispatches her sons, Hamdir and Surli, to avenge themselves on King Jormunrekkr, that's Ermanric, or the reflex of him, for having killed their sister. And on the way, they meet their half-brother, Erpr. Their verbal exchange is particularly interesting for the metaphors it uses. How can a foot help a foot, or a hand made of flesh help a hand? Hamdir and Surli don't understand this metaphor based on body parts. And so they kill their half-brother. I'm not recommending that if you don't understand a metaphor, you kill your sibling. This might be a bit exaggerated, but we're in the realm of heroic legend here, not everyday life. And this, at the time, seems a reasonable thing to these two people. And the poet reminds us in a subsequent stanza that this action diminished their forces by a third. And indeed, their attack fails. Hamdir and Surli hack off the hands and feet of Jormunrekkr, more body parts, and hurl them into the fire. But Jormunrekkr understands that they are invulnerable to ordinary weapons, and he orders his men to stone the brothers. Now they understand the folly of killing their half-brother. Note the use of the word brother here. The head would be off if Erpr were alive, our battle-bold brother, as opposed to the use of son of a different mother in the previous stanza that I put up. They're now suggesting that, in fact, half-brothers are full brothers, that they have misunderstood the way the kinship system works or can work, and might be imagined to work. And this early denial of proper kinship is now too late set right. It's also worth pointing out on the other. It's also worth pointing out the value of the Old Norse dual pronoun. This is, of course, leaping right off the screen at everyone here. Now that you are this side, you have to see it. So we there, is it Old Norse has dual in the pronoun system. So where is it? We two, there we go. This is actually obfuscatory devices. I'm pointing at everything but the place I want to point. So the language allows them to be perfectly clear. He would be alive if we too had not slain him. Were he alive, we'd be using the plural pronoun and not the dual pronoun. In other versions of the story, there are two, one in Snorri Sturluson's Edda and the other in Volsunga Saga, the three are full brothers, not half brothers. and after they kill Edward, one or both of the brothers stumbles, making clear how hands and feet can help one another. And probably limping, walking, I believe. I prefer the version of Hum this novel, but the import is the same. Kin are like parts on a body. And to kill kin in this metaphor is to hack off a body part. Readers of or listeners to this story simply had to equate the body part metaphor with the failure to slay King Jormungandr despite hacking off his hands and feet. His head, the seat of speech, is sufficient to doom the surviving brothers through his command to stone them. And by the way, Jormungandr was a kinslayer too. And that act is part of the story, although it's not in the poem that I've been referencing here. Jormungandr had dispatched his son to bring back to him Svanhildr, the daughter of Gudrun, the sister of Hamdir and Surtli, the people who were screen here, as his intended bride. And when the son instead thought to marry Svanhildr, Jormungandr had him hung, and then subsequently he trampled Svanhildr under horse's hooves, thus setting off the journey of Hamdir and Surtli. From the gallows, the son sent a plucked eagle to his father, who recognized the metaphor, you cannot fly without feathers. And it may be a stretch, but feathers seem to me to be body parts on eagles, just as hands and feet are body parts, not human beings. So, I think his own loss of hands and feet parallels the self-inflicted loss of his son. He killed his kin and maimed his body. This finding accords with legal metaphor. In Old Norse laws, people could reckon the closeness of kinship relationships by using knees. Each of us is two knees from grandparents, and one knee from parents, children, and siblings. Although there is evidence, as I'm sure many of you know, that Germanic laws in general may have used body parts as markers of kin, as in the Sachsenspiegel, which is, by the way, at exactly the same time as our textual material, the first half of the 13th century. This works from the neck down and out to the hands to indicate degrees of kinship relation. I'm not prepared to argue that that metaphor survived into Old Norse, and it's not my topic today. But we certainly do, in the end, have body parts also as metaphors for degrees of kinship, as well as within the metaphorical system of heroic poetry and myth. When Snorri and the Volsunga saga author tell this story, they end it with the line, the head would be off if Edward now lived, and indeed this proverbial expression, and it is proverbial, sums up the terrible downside of kinslaying in the heroic arena, just as the death of Baldur does in myth. Both gods and heroes lived in a cosmos built from the body parts of a murdered relative, and that's precious little better than living in a house built on sand. The story of Hamdir, Surtli, and Erpur implies a hierarchy of body parts. When Snorri tells the story in Skaldskaparmal, he has their mother, Gudrun, order them to attack the sleeping Jormungandr in the dark of night, Surtli and Hamdir to hack off the hands and feet, and Erpur, obviously the head, by the bait, it's my sort of gesturing toward old folklore scholarship, by the basic narrative ruler three, or listen up, by Ulrich's law of the weight of final position, Erpur and the head are the most important, and Snorri makes this almost embarrassingly clear when he motivates the killing of Erpur through the jealousy of his brothers. As usual, myth provides the clearest examples of the metaphorical thinking in which body parts represent individuals and their relationship with groups. One such example is Kvasir, made from mixed spittle of two groups of gods who've been at war, then murdered by dwarves who convert his blood into the meat of poetry. Thus, poetry in this culture, the means for storing and processing the past, and a great tool of the Ubra god Odin, originated from the symbol of the coalescence of two groups of deities, and was once the blood of a god, just as the sea, which defines the outer limit of the cosmos, was once the blood of a giant, and now by me defined in both cases as body parts put to varying kinds of use. Even more striking is a parallel story about the convergence of these two groups of gods, Æsir and Vanir are their names. This version is found in the Ynglinga saga of Snorri Sturluson's Heimskringla, probably around 1230. After the war, the two groups in this euhemerized version, presented as warring tribes in Asia, not as groups of gods, exchange hostages, that is, persons held as security for the fulfillment of certain terms. Njörður and Frey and their sister Freya, who's not named in this exchange on the screen, will play very important roles among the Æsir, and from their perspective, the terms of the truce have been fulfilled. Not so for the Vanir. As security, Hænir and Mímir are pledges, just like Odin's eye and Heimdall's hearing. And from the Vanir's perspective, the terms of the truce were not fulfilled. The security was forfeit, again, just like Odin's eye, Heimdall's hearing, and Tyr's hand. I'll let you read that. That's another amusing story here. This is when I sit in faculty meetings or any kind of meeting, and my colleagues hear me say "Ráði Aðrir." They don't know what I mean, but I do, and now you do. This is an enormously handy technique, but it obviously is a bit of a sham in the exchange of pledges. And as we've seen, pledges in the mythology, when they are body parts, tend to be forfeits. And Mimir's life is forfeit. And here again, we have another severed body part, a symbol of a broken pledge or a breaking down of a system of keeping order. Yet like the other body parts in the mythology, this one too will have a positive power through a ritual or magic act. Odin's lost eye confers cosmic vision. Heimdall's lost hearing provides guardian powers. The head of Mimir, think here of the trunk and head of Jörmungandr, I find that helpful, provides powerful and secret speech. It's worth noting that in this, I'm not going to run around with the pointer and point out the word Stavi at the end of the Old Norse. It's just worth pointing out that Stavir, which is, I think, correctly translated letters here because of the context we're talking about runes, also generally means details of mythological and cultural information. So the head is capable of speaking about runes, but in my view is speaking about mythic knowledge in general. And over the years, I've speculated far too much on Mimir's head, and I've gone on record suggesting it might be a kind of pagan relic, which I still think is not completely implausible. An analog of a shaman mask, an analog to the corpse of Pallas in medieval adaptations of Virgil, and as a site of the anointing of kings. And within the curve of the grand mythological plot, however, the head obviously attaches to just one thing, and that is the strategies of Odin. And this passage from Völuspá, yet another one, describes the run-up to the last battle between gods and giants, the one that will end with the destruction of the entire cosmos. We don't know who Mimir's sons are, or exactly how fate should catch fire. But we do know that Heimdall is to blow his horn when he discerns the approach of the giants, for it is just at this moment that Odin speaks with the head. Here we see forfeit body parts distilled into a single moment. Odin with his one eye, speaking with the severed head of Mimir, while the hearless or earless Heimdall is tuning his horn, and the wolf is running free, bound by the one-handed god Tyr. All of these things occur at just this moment. And thus, here, finally, the metaphoric system has come full circle. The gods created the cosmos by murdering a maternal ancestor, and they acquired short-term protective powers against the offspring of their victim by forfeiting body parts. That is, they metaphorically repudiated their own kinship ties, in this case, written on their own bodies. Mimir may tell it best. He was forfeit through a sham deal, in which the euhemerized Aesir got powerful priests, and the Vanir got what amounted to a fast-talking used car salesman. The main bodies of Odin, Heimdall, Tyr, and Mimir, like the dead bodies of Ymir and Baldur, are all signs of broken systems for keeping the social order. Kinship was a metaphorical body, and these systems could not keep it intact. The example of Önundur Pegleg, with which I began this talk, shows that disability in the human world became a part of identity. And the example of Harald Matted Hair, turned Harald Fair Hair, shows that the body could be a site of political or national identity as well. Heroic legend, and especially myth, offer different ways to think of bodies, identities, and politics. When the gods or the powers tore asunder the body of Ymir, they destroyed a metaphorical kin group in a way that could never be remedied, even by forfeiting their own body parts. Thank you.
We can maybe turn the lights up at this point, and then would you like to field your own questions?
Sure, yeah.
Well, there's one. This is, as you put it earlier, attack not taken. But you did mention it when we talked in lunch about funerary rites and the various dismemberments and stuff. And I was wondering if you would mind maybe saying something about that.
No, not at all. Thank you for asking me, because this is something that I thought might have been relevant for this talk. And it's this, that Viking Age funerary ritual, which, by the way, is a very hot topic now within Viking Age archaeologists, is frequently uncovering the fact that severed bodies were part of sending people off to the other world. They weren't human bodies. Dogs were popular, horses, sheep, but one of the things you did when you sent someone off to the other world was cut up a body. And I can see that this would equate very well with the stories we've talked about now, because you end the era of chaos, as it were, in the mythological system by killing and cutting up a body. You move that, as to say, from one, in this case, largely social status to another. In the case of someone dying, you're moving the dead person from the realm of the living to the realm of the dead. To put this another way, before Ymir is killed, the universe is still inchoate. It's gone between being nothing and something, so it's at a liminal state, and we seem to be cutting up bodies at liminal states. And I'll give the last example that I was going to bring here, and this is the case of the father of Harald Matted Hair. I was about to say Harald Nay Matted Hair turned fair hair. He was born, I guess, and maybe he was, he took the nickname on because he just let his hair go for, you know, it was, you remember, 8 years, 12 years? Yeah. So he was pretty disreputable looking. His father was the last king who did not rule over a united Norway. He was the first of the two Halfdan the Blacks. And according to one story, when he died, all the districts of Norway all wanted his body. And so what do you do in a case like that? So you make a sort of Solomonic compromise, and you chop the body up into four parts, and you put the parts in, four parts in four different parts of Norway. And it's actually Bruce Lincoln who's made this argument that what we have here is a sort of mythological chaos being now, let's say, this thing I've just told you about is a political echo of the mythological original chaos. You kill the giant to create order out of chaos. You take the body parts and of the last non-united king in order to indicate the transition to a politically unified state, and then, of course, when you're putting someone into the grave, you use body parts to mark them. The body parts are positioned. We also talked at lunch today about Ibn Fadlan's Rus funeral, and there actually they do move. They take a chicken and cut its head off, and they throw it from the world of the living over this bar, which is the limb and the barrier. They throw it into the world of the dead. So, I mean, they're lots of ways one could go with body parts that I didn't feel I had time to do today. So I think Richard was actually next.
I just going to ask whether cutting off body parts is a regular punishment in
The answer to that is both is no technically, but it's not allowed to do in the law. So there are stipulations about the wear guilt payments for body parts that are taken off, but it's not a kind of standard thing except on slaves, and then that's not regulated. So indeed, the distinction in the Old Norse world between the free people and unfree, the thralls or slaves as they were, was that their bodies could be marked in any way. And in fact, one of the things that people sometimes did to indicate that a slave was sort of slit the nostrils. So if you felt like cutting the hand off a slave or a foot, that was the owner's prerogative. If you do that to a free man, then you get into the whole wear guilt system where lots of repayment has to be directed back toward the family. This is another thing I didn't have time to get into today, but if I get a chance to write this up, I think it would be in there. I think it's Dory and then you.
Oh, well, your answer to Damon made me wonder about the possible Christian relationships here, given that your texts are from the Christian era. What about the cult of relics and the use of relics in cementing political relationships? Could it influence the texts, or conversely, did the mythology perhaps influence what happened to saints in Iceland?
I would say no to the second question. I'm quite sure that there was people were aware of the fact that that body parts were relics within the church, and you know, people had even seen the reliquaries and so forth. And so this is why I think that I think Mimir's head actually comes the closest to this, because it's actually a valuable object which moves from one place to another. To a lesser degree, the blood that becomes the meat of poetry behaves that way. Again, it's a precious object that's brought in and is kept in one place. These other body parts, I guess you could say, thank you for this question, because I hadn't thought of it this way, but I mean, if you actually put your eye or you put this ear, of course you're doing it yourself, which is kind of a no-no for a saint, but if it is lodged there, then that is the center of the universe, which is where the church is after all. So I feel sure that the people were capable of multiple understandings of these things, and in fact our authors even play on this sometimes and talk, not in the area of relics, but talk more generally about how Norse paganism was groping its way toward Christianity. They just sort of didn't know. Snorri tells us they forgot the name of God, and everything went downhill from there. And so they created this whole system that was wrong. So I think you're next there, and then you.
So it seems like there is a lot of examples of dismemberment between males.
Yeah.
Is there any examples of giantesses?
Well, many giantesses are so misshapen that I can't think of a. Mara's going to help me here. I don't think of any giantesses whose body parts are hacked off. I mean, there are trolls in the forefathers over there who kind of, you kill them and they turn back into a princess. But
I have a dim memory of some giantess threatening a hero with her claws and then her the solution being her hands cut off. I think that's in one of the other poems. But.
The thing I thought that was maybe a close substitute maybe was Brendis, the necklace that's given?
The bracing on that, yeah. You mean it's removed from
yeah,
from
maybe
Fred,
it's
so,
like
yeah.
A...
Yeah, I mean, we could start working with that. And then we could say that she's deprived of this... Okay, she... Freya has this thing, which is called the brising on men, and men is a valuable object or a necklace, and so we think of it as a necklace. It's the brosing on men in Beowulf, yeah. And there's a late story that tells us that it was removed from her body by the same Loki here, taken away. So she doesn't have that. So Frey doesn't have his sword. He gave it away for sexual purposes. My sword. Thor's hammer is defective. It's the handle is short. There's all set of object deficiencies going on in the mythology as well. They're not, so if you think of your weapon as a body part, which maybe these people might have done in some instances, then yes, I'll take that. In general, as you know, this is a very hyper-masculine system, and so we don't get much going on with these women.
Oh, you see the naming of Volander or Wayland in English, and this member of Peak of the Suns is tying in here, or is this?
Yeah, I do act. Volander is hamstrung in the Norse tradition, and he actually acquires, as these other people in the mythology do, some kind of apparently acquires a supernatural ability in smithing. In addition, he can fly. So yes, I would bring that in. I think that's a good point. Thank you.
I was just kind of wondering why would some of these people be like lose a leg but not be killed? So.
Well, you're thinking of Unnethur Pegleg. I mean, the text says he was Orvi. He was incapable of fighting anymore. So, and they actually take him away, and he's cured. Sometimes a body part gets hacked off, and then they're not okay. They just die on the spot. And I think it's Laxness, yeah, who did the quip about the sagas, at least, that the sagas are the fantasy literature of a people who could not make a sharp sword. But it's certainly true that if you are fighting with an axe and you have sufficient, and swords were, of course, two-handed, great big things, and you get a lot of momentum. I could imagine that you could do a whole lot of damage with a sword. It might take more than one blow to get a body part.
There's the deathless line from Njal Saga.
Yeah.
Fight scene, one guy hacks at another says, there's no need to look, just sort of stands there. Says, there's no need to look, the leg is off. The fellow whose leg is now off says, that's what I get for not bringing my shield, falls over and dies. So that did it.
Yeah. The dying quip is one of the more delightful tropes of this literature.
I've got a comment. An example springs to mind of other kinsmen who are cut off body parts because of the verb avhenta, which I think is offhand, but to cut off, just in the expanded sense. And in Theodorantathaltur, the ticked off kinsmen are described as avhentur freintur.
Yeah.
So the cut-off kinsman, it shows up one other place, but I forget where. So
yeah, that's exactly the same metaphor. So this is another example of how pervasive this metaphor was in this system.
Could it be that there are two different systems of dismemberment going on? Because we have Ymir that creates order after being dismembered. We have the parallel with history of the king.
Hmm.
And then we have dismemberment gone poorly when Baldur dies, if we're saying that kinship is equivalent to a body part.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if that creates chaos instead of order, and if they're different, or?
It's both, either both, really. I mean, look, it's mythology, so. One of the things going here is, you kill the proto-giant and say, okay, the proto-giant is dead, yay. I mean, what is, Thor was supposedly the most widely known and worshipped god in the old system, and he's certainly the only one who left artifacts. So these little Thor's hammers, the archaeological record, they're not little Odin spears. I thought I should maybe create these things and have an industry. You can buy an Odin spear, or you can buy a sword for Frey. You can buy a Frey's sword or whatever, but in the archaeological record, there are just these hammers, but there are a lot of them, and there are a couple of records even that people have them. And so if he's the protector god, and what his job is mainly to go out killing giants, that's a good thing. But paradoxically, that good thing was embedded in the bad thing of the kinslaying, so it's either both. But there is a difference between killing, dismembering, and ordering on the one hand, and this sort of deliberate loss of a body part. So they're two aspects of the same dominant cultural metaphor of the body as a kinship.
Yeah.
If there are no more questions, then let us thank our speaker and let those of you who can stay join us afterwards for more conversation.